Okay, I'm going to report on some work in progress that I've been doing with Juan Malbuchena and Nadi Zyberg, trying to understand better some of the physical implications and meaning of the K-theory classification of brain charges. I'll start with a motivating introduction, then talk about the physics of the K-theory versus the cohomology classification of brain charges. We'll skip over the applications to the WZW models. I'll focus on the physical interpretation of the K-theory group for SU2, say a little bit about singletons, and then summarize. Well, D-brain charges and Ramon-Ramon fluxes are classified by K-theory, and there's three style of arguments for supporting that. One is just based on very primitive notions of sewing and topological field theory. One already has led to a structure of K-theory. The most famous route proceeds by brain, anti-brain annihilation, and the Sen conjectures. If you go down that road, you're led to open string field theory, non-commutative geometry, and the solitons are related to projection operators, and from there you start to classify brains by the K-theory of some kind of algebra, because that's about projection operators. And a third route proceeds by topological terms and actions, like the Chern-Simons term and the M-theory action and the brain actions. But all these arguments hold at weak coupling and smooth spaces. And moreover, there's some tension between the K-theory classification of charges and U-duality, and also with the ADS-CFT correspondence. So a problem that is potentially fruitful for the near future that I think is interesting is the question of whether there is a more broadly applicable homotopy classification of brains and fluxes. And even defining this question, even formulating this question in a useful and precise context might even be useful. So in this talk, we'll make a small step in that direction by seeing that sometimes the K-theory classification of charges can be misleading, and then we'll see how to correct it. But it's really just a small step, as you'll see for yourselves. Well, to set that stage, I need to talk about the one way of understanding the difference in terms of physics between the K-theory and the cohomology classification of charges. So space-time will be a product of time and space. And let's ask a simple question. What cycles, curly W, can a brain wrap in space? Now, in the cohomological classification, a free brain, a brain that doesn't have other brains ending on it, a free brain can wrap any non-trivial homology cycle, like Saran wrap, and when it does so, it's absolutely stable. But it turns out, in K-theory, instead of A and B, we have A prime and B prime. A prime says that a D brain can wrap a cycle W only if, in Durham theory, the H flux restricted to W is zero in cohomology. And integrally, the statement is refined to this combination of cohomology classes equals zero. Now, in this talk, you can put capital W3 to zero, and you can put Steenrod squares to zero, and you will be able to follow the talk. I just write it here to write correct equations. But it's not essential to the talk. Instead of B, we have B prime, which says that brains can wrap a homologically non-trivial cycle W and nevertheless be unstable if there exists some W prime such that the Poincaré dual of W in W prime is this combination of cohomology classes for W prime. So I'll now explain A prime and B prime. Well, A prime is well known. It follows in the Durham theory because on the brain, H must be trivialized. And the integral generalization follows from the cancellation of global anomalies, as shown by Friedan-Witten. What about B prime? Well, suppose that there is a cycle, curly W prime. Suppose that such a cycle exists such that this combination of cohomology classes is not zero. Then we can't wrap brains on capital W prime. I just said that. Well, let's do it anyway, okay? If we do it anyway, we have a global anomaly to cancel. And since it's sitting in space, it's sitting at a particular time, so it's a D-brain instant time. How do we cancel the anomaly? We cancel the anomaly by having another D-brain end on this, on a cycle W, such that this Poincaré dual is this combination of cohomology classes, because a brain ending on W is a magnetic source for the F field on W prime. And the interpretation of this is manifest from the picture. A brain wraps a cycle W and it propagates in time and stops. That means it decays. Okay? So D instantons simply lead to decay of brains wrapping W. Now, why is this a condition of K theory? So now I'm going to explain that A prime and B prime are in fact conditions of K theory. And I'm going to explain that by showing that A prime and B prime are two crucial procedures in the computation of K theory via the Atiyah-Herzebruch spectral sequence. So I have to say a little bit about what the AHSS is. So let's remember that in type 2A theory, the charges is the K1 group of X9, roughly speaking. And similarly in 2B, we have the K0 group. Now, if you're given a K theory class, then you get a system of integral cohomology classes. So you all know that very well. For X and K0, you get a bunch of Chern classes, which are even degree cohomology classes. A similar procedure for X and K1 leads to a system of odd degree cohomology classes. And how do we think about that in physical terms? Well, let's think about K1. The Poincaré dual of omega 1 in X9 is an 8 cycle. That's where the 8 brain lives, and so on up to the Poincaré dual of omega 9 in X9, which is where the D0 brain lives. So in this way, a system of cohomology classes determines a collection of brains. And now you can ask the converse question, given a system of cohomology classes, does it come from a K-theory class? And the answer in general is no. And one way of summarizing the relations between these classes is via the Atiyah-Herzebruch spectral sequence, which is a successive approximation scheme for deciding when such a system comes from a K-theory class. Okay, so what is the AHSS? Well, the first approximation sets K0 equal to the even cohomology and K1 equal to the odd cohomology. That's the first approximation. The next approximation, the first non-trivial correction, takes the cohomology of the cohomology. So it takes this space and it defines an operator on this space which squares to zero. And that operator is D3, which in Durham theory is just wedging with the H field. Okay? And if you're in the integral world, it's a little more complicated. It involves a Steenrod square. Now, in general, once you've computed the cohomology with respect to D3, you're not done. You have to do D5 and so on. But because we're in small dimensions like 10 and 11, we can stop at D3 in most but not all cases. Okay, so now what I'm going to do, having told you about the AHSS, is I'm going to interpret the procedure of taking D3 cohomology in terms of the physical conditions I gave you before. So let's start with the kernel. Well, if you insist, the Steenrod square is cupping with this W3. So the kernel, D3 of A equals 0, is this condition. And you see that if we set W equal to Poincaré dual of A, then the global anomaly cancellation on W means this is 0, and therefore certainly we're in the kernel of D3. So the physical condition A prime implies you're in the kernel of D3. It's actually, the physical condition has a little more information because it only says that this cup A is 0. Now what about the image? This is the point that's slightly new. Suppose that A is in the image of D3. Well, if we set the Poincaré dual of A is W and the Poincaré dual of A prime is W prime, then we have the picture from before where W is codimension 3 in W prime, and a brain wrapping W can be a magnetic source for the gauge field on W prime. And this condition that I stated before for canceling the global anomalies by one brain ending on the other implies that A is in the image of D3. So the D instanton induced instability implies the quotient by the image of D3. Okay, so let me make three comments on this. The first is that a very similar remark was made in a paper about a year ago by Emmanuel Giaconescu and Edward Witten and myself. And I dare say my collaborators understood this more clearly than I did, but I found it illuminating to find this simple picture of the brain decay mechanism. In particular, this discussion applies when H is not torsion. Now, when H is torsion, Witten showed that the correct D brain charge group is KH of X. But when H is not torsion, well, it was suggested by Balknecht and Mattai, but it's not immediately obvious that that's the right thing to do. Nevertheless, this supports that. It's also important to bear in mind that the physical conditions actually contain more information and are stronger than computing D3 cohomology. And that comes up, for example, in computing the K-theory group for SU3, the SU3 WZW model. And if there's time and interest, I can come back to that. But I want to focus on a simpler case, the SU2 WZW model, where the K-theory group, the computation of the K-theory group is trivial. So let's suppose we have a space, X9, which is a product of a 6-space and a 3-sphere. And suppose the 3-sphere has H flux on it with K units. So omega 3 is the volume form. So we have a conformal field theory, which is the level K SU2 WZW model. Now, it's hopeless to try and explain a computation in real time. The calculation, however, is completely trivial using the AHSS, computing kernel mod image of D3. And K0 is 0, and K1 is Z mod KZ. Okay? So the K-theory group, the group of charges, is Z mod KZ. Now, what is the Z mod KZ? This is what we want to understand physically. Well, there is a very beautiful interpretation of this in terms of D0 brains, which blow up into spheres, which wrap Verlinde conjugacy classes, they're stabilized by fluxes, and there's a large literature on that. Very, very beautiful story. But I want to focus on the NS5 brain backgrounds that lead to this WZW model, and ask about how do we understand the D0 charge group being ZK. Why is it ZK? Because of this picture. A D2 instanton can wrap the S3 and K D0 brains can end on. So KD0 brains just disappear. Okay, we want to understand that. So we'll study this question first using type 2A supergravity, and then using brain probes, and then using M-theory. And the route we're going to take is circuitous. So fasten your seatbelt. We're going to first justify it, and then I'm going to contradict it, and then I'll resolve the contradiction. Okay? So we begin with the standard type 2A charge K NS5 brain. Here's the metric, dilaton H field. So X is parallel to the brain, Y is transverse, R is the radial direction, and we have H flux on the linking 3-sphere. Well, the first thing we do is look at the throat region, okay, and think about the space-time physics in the throat region. So space-time is to be thought of as a seven-dimensional space times a 3-sphere, and we're going to do Kaluza-Klein reduction along the 3-sphere. Okay, so the Ramond-Ramon three-form potential becomes a scalar and a three-form in seven-dimensional space. The Ramond-Ramon one-form just becomes a one-form in seven-dimensional space. And here's the Lagrangian from type 2A supergravity. So focus on these from the Ramond-Ramon sector. This is just the Abelian-Higgs model, right? Because we have a scalar coupled to the gauge field. And you recognize that chi, the scalar chi coming from C3, is just the Goldstone boson of a condensed Higgs field. Okay, if we define a Higgs field, phi, whose modulus has been fixed by some potential, phi is e to the I chi, that is e to the I period of C3, then this is a Higgs field of charge K. Okay, under the Ramond-Ramon gauge transformations, because under Ramond-Ramon gauge transformations, C3 varies by H wedge lambda 0. Okay, so phi Higgs has charge K. But look, if a Higgs field of charge K condenses, then it leaves unbroken a ZK gauge group. And therefore, the group of charges is the dual group, which is again ZK. So the ZK torsion group of charges is completely standard from this point of view. It's just the condensation of a Higgs field of non-minimal charge. Well, that's one way to understand the ZK. Here's another way. Let's think about brain probes. So consider now a D2 brain probe, which is parallel to the 5 brain and sitting at fixed values of R and the angular coordinates of S3. And now we have a U1 gauge field, gauge theory on the D2 brain. That's a three-dimensional U1 gauge theory. And long ago, Polyakov taught us that instantons in the gauge theory will break the U1 symmetry and give the photon a mass. And the physics of this is clearer if we dualize on the world volume of the D2 brain, introducing instead a scalar, and in modern language, that's just going to an M2 brain. So we think about M2 brain instantons which wrap the S3 and correct the low energy effect of Lagrangian on the M2 brain. I did, but let me repeat it. The D2 brain is a three-dimensional field theory, which is at a point in the S3. That three-dimensional field theory has corrections to it. Those corrections come from the instantons. So the low energy effective Lagrangian of that theory, transverse to the S3, has these instanton corrections. And the supersymmetry is broken, so in fact they correct the potential. And so we get this potential here, with an explicit breaking of U1 to Z mod K. Well, this is all well and good, but now let's think about it from the M-theory point of view. And we start to get confused. At least I do. If we have K M5 brains transverse to the M-theory circle, just arranged in some way, well, then we can write down the metric. Okay, so we have the usual metric involving some harmonic function made periodic. We have an explicit sum over 1 to K here. And at long distances, of course, we get the usual NS5 brain. But these positions here break translation invariance in the Y5 direction. So at long distances, the ZK symmetry appears to be an accidental symmetry. Moreover, you get even more confused when you remember that D0 brains get light as they go in towards the core of the M5 brain, so there's clearly no D0 charge conservation at all. They just all want to fall in. Well, that leads you to confusions about the strong coupling singularity. So let's cut off the strong coupling singularity to make the question well-defined. K-theory was only supposed to be good in the weak coupling limit anyway. So let's consider the following system of 2A spacetimes. We have a bounded string coupling. We have a 9-dimensional space whose boundary is an 8-dimensional space, which has an S3 fiber, or an S3 factor, with H-flux on it. So for example, just think of the near-extremal NS5 brain of charge K, or of the ADS3 times S3 times FM4 times type geometries. So in all these cases, you can compute the K-theory group, and it suggests that the D0 charge group is Z mod K. And you can compute it because you can just look at the, you can do the computation at infinity, and it only depends on the topology at infinity. So the M-theory viewpoint makes it clear what's going on. If the M5 brains are transverse to the M-theory circle, and they have a finite mass, well, for example, because they wrap a finite dimension, finite volume space, well, then they can move. They can move in the M-theory circle direction. Or put differently, think about the U1 translation invariance in the M-theory circle. It's broken if we ignore the center of mass, or if the 5 brains have an infinite center of mass. And it's unbroken if the 5 brains have a finite center of mass, center of mass, and we include their degrees of freedom. So you can say this a little more quantitatively, thinking about the wave function of the system as a function of these positions on the circle. You can split the wave function into a center of mass wave function and a wave function for the relative coordinates. The Q here is the D0 charge. It's the momentum conjugate to the center of mass. And it's an integer. But the relative wave function only depends on Q modulo K. So if you neglect the center of mass, K D0 brains can just disappear in that sense, because this only depends on Q mod K. Well, that sounds trivial, but it's still worth understanding it from the previous points of view, since I argued the opposite before. We've now said that the Z0 charge group is Z, not ZK, so what happened? Well, let's go to the space-time of type 2A theory. And we can implement the physical intuition that we just had before by lifting the solution up to M-theory, boosting along the M-theory circle, and then Kaluza Klein reducing. And if you do that, you'll find that you've turned on Ramon-Ramon potentials, C3 and C1. Chi of t is just some function of time. And this solves the Ramon-Ramon equations of motion. And moreover, the zero mode of chi is a collective coordinate. So if the M5 brain has a finite mass, then this 3-form omega-3 is a normalizable 3-form, and chi is therefore normalizable. And large Ramond-Ramond gauge transformations make chi periodic, and therefore the excitations of chi can carry D0 charge, and the D0 charge group is Z and not ZK. In terms of the probe Lagrangian, the field XM becomes an axion and restores the symmetry. Okay, now the phenomenon I'm talking about is actually very similar, and in fact you do all, to the phenomenon of unwinding of fundamental strings in the charge K Kaluza-Klein monopole. That's something I discussed some years ago with Ruth Gregory and Jeff Harvey. So let's remind ourselves about what a multi-tau nut space looks like. So it has a projection to R3. The generic fiber is a circle, and sometimes that fiber degenerates, and out at infinity, the radius of that fiber stabilizes. But topologically, the boundary at infinity is a Lenz space times a radial direction. Okay, so out at infinity, there's an apparent ZK winding charge group. On the other hand, the multi-tau nut space, when resolved, is simply connected. So you might be led to conclude that the charge group is not ZK, but in fact, zero. Well, in fact, neither of these is the right answer from the point of view of winding charge. If you're careful about looking at the unwinding configuration at infinity, you find that it induces a radial flow of charge into the center, which accounts for where the charge went. And another way of looking at it, which connects to this talk, is that there's a collective coordinate for the B field, because there's a harmonic normalizable 2-form on multi-tau nut space. And that is a periodic normalizable collective coordinate, and it carries its dionic excitations carry the charge. Okay, there's yet another point of view on what's going on here from a Chern-Simons viewpoint. When you take near horizon limits and look at low energies, you find BF theories or Chern-Simons topological theories from the Ramond-Ramond sector and sometimes from the Nebo-Schwartz sector. And the quantization of these systems can lead to field theoretic modes propagating on the boundary. And these modes can carry the, quote, missing charges. And whether or not they do depends on what you consider the gauge transformations to be in your theory. And that choice, the point of this talk, is that that choice should be determined by embedding within the larger theory before you took the near horizon limit. So there's a famous example of this kind of thing in three-dimensional Chern-Simons theory. If you have a billion gauge field and you make a singular gauge transformation, you can induce a Wilson line of charge K in the interior. Okay. Well, I have an example of that, which I think is a little too long-winded. So I'll skip it and I'll go to example two, which is let's now think about U-duality in the geometry ADS3 times S3 times T4 from this point of view. So if we consider type 2B strings on R6 times T4, the U-duality group is SO55Z. And in six dimensions, there are particles and strings. And the particle charge lattice is the spinner, Z16, okay? And the string charge lattice is the vector, the 10 of SO55, the even unimodular lattice. And we can think of it as a particular kind of symmetric bispinner. So the near horizon limit is defined by choosing a kind of string and taking the near horizon limit of that geometry. So to define a near horizon limit, you need to choose a vector q, and then the Chern-Simons theory is that of 16 abelian gauge fields with these values of k, if you like. And if you make that kind of singular gauge transformation, you'll induce a Wilson line of, well, if the gauge transformation had parameters p alpha, you'll induce a Wilson line of type q times p alpha. So the group of charges carried by the Wilson line is a finite group, the quotient of p by lambda of p, where lambda is this action of multiplying p by q. And this group is just zk to the eighth power, where k is computed from q squared. And I'm assuming q is primitive. Otherwise, they're complicated dynamics. So a simple example of what I'm saying is given by Q5 NS5 brains with Q1 parallel fundamental strings. And the phenomenon I've been talking about in this talk is that the D1 and the D3 charges are broken down to ZQ5 by the H flux. So they're finite. And that's just proceeding by Euclidean instantons on S3 times T1 and S3 times T3. And then we also have the phenomenon of the fundamental string charges apparently broken to ZQ1, as I explained for the Kaluza-Klein monopole. And there's a T-dual of that situation where the momenta are broken to ZQ1 by NS5 brain instantons. Okay, so all that fits together into this finite group, and Q1 and Q5 are relatively prime, so that's this. But we also know that including the singleton degrees of freedom, the actual charge group is Z. Okay, so let me conclude. By clarifying the meaning of the AHSS, we've given some further arguments for the physical relevance of the group KH of X in the case of non-torsion H. And as I said before, for the case of torsion H, it was already justified in Witten's original paper, and further explained in Fried and Witten and Kapustin. The physical criteria, A prime and B prime, I didn't explain this, but let me just mention it again, can actually contain more information and can sometimes determine the K group when the AHSS is difficult to use. More importantly, the torsion of KH theory charges can be interpreted in very concrete and standard physical mechanisms. For example, the condensation of a non-minimal charged Higgs field or the Polyakov mechanism on B-brain probes. But then if you start to think about M theory, you see there's a bigger picture, and this torsion is connected to a lot of, well, a very interesting circle of questions having to do with ADS singletons, higher dimensional Chern-Simons theories, and this kind of unwinding of strings and Kaluza-Klein monopoles. The main message is this. The interpretation of KH of X when H is not torsion should be done with care, because if you include certain M theory degrees of freedom or Ramon-Ramon degrees of freedom, you can change what you call the charge group rather drastically. Okay, thank you.
Okay, are there questions for Greg? Tom?
Yeah, I think that's too strong because, I mean, right. Well, you can complete the sentence. So sometimes the group really is ZK. The message is that it's subtle, and you shouldn't bear in mind the possibility that there are other degrees of freedom which can change your conclusions.
Are there other questions? Okay, if not, then let's thank Greg again.